morning. The second case is 97-2284, Warsaw Tile versus County Concrete Corporation. Ms. Erlinson is at the podium of the Mary Walker firm, and you represent Warsaw Tile.
That's correct, Your Honors. I'm here on behalf of appellant Warsaw Tile this morning. In my argument, I will touch on two reasons why the economic loss doctrine does not bar Warsaw Tile's tort claims. The first, the presence of allegations of property damage and personal injury in the complaint. And second, in the alternative, and if this court should find those allegations inadequate, this court should adopt a safety hazard exception to the economic loss rule. I will not be addressing the insurance coverage issue this morning unless the justices have specific questions on that issue. As we note in our briefs, this case can be resolved very simply without a need to consider the utility of a safety hazard exception. Warsaw Tile has alleged that the cement caused personal injury and damage to other property, namely to its pavers, and in fact we have spent over $1 million remedying that damage, and to a customer's adjacent property, and we estimate over $100,000 remedying that type of damage. That damage to the pavers was unexpected. The cement worked for its normal commercial purpose. It bound aggregate and water together to form concrete, and it's still binding those materials. The problem with the cement was not that it damaged itself, it was that we got something unusual and unexpected, something that we had never seen before in our 36-plus years of working with concrete. The high alkalinity in the cement caused an additional reaction, an alkali-silica reaction, which we described in our briefs. Now, in that reaction, the cement disrupts or dissolves part of the silica-containing aggregate to form a foreign substance. It's not usually present in concrete, called silica gel. Silica gel has the property of expanding in the presence of water and humidity. After the concrete pavers were exposed to the elements for a year or two, the pockets of silica gel expanded to the point where they began to warp and bend the concrete pavers so that they would become concave bowls or convex domes, and eventually some of them would crack. And that is how the cement damaged the aggregate in the pavers. It's an additional reaction that created a foreign element in the pavers. Now, it's well established that the economic loss doctrine does not apply to cases in which personal injury and damage to other property is alleged. This court need go no farther than that to resolve that case.
Counsel, let me ask, so it's a simple allegation that if I allege that someone was injured, then you fall outside of the economic loss doctrine and you can bring a tort. Why can't the people that are injured, they have a cause of action too, don't they?
Yes.
Now, isn't it, and my other question is, isn't it standard that you're saying that this cement was, it didn't act like it was expected and normally, but isn't that exactly what happens in it didn't work for its intended purpose? Isn't that what exactly happens in the economic loss doctrine? Isn't that what happened in, for example, the Dannon case or in Sunny Slope? What's the difference?
Well, you have two questions there. Let me address the personal injury one first. With regard to personal injury, since we have not yet settled any of those claims or actually spent money on those claims, you're right. Those people still retain their own actions. However, in the case of the damage to customers, you know, other property, we fixed that. We have incurred the cost, not they. And we have control of the action, control of the fruits of that. We are the ones entitled to seek the return of that money rather than the customers.
What's the damage to other property?
Some of the damage involves damage to adjoining curbs and walls, and also to, in some situations, they were set in mortar beds, which the whole subbed was destroyed and had to be removed. Addressing your other question, Justice Wilcox, you were asking about, wasn't this expected damage? You're correct. In some cases, one might expect that cement wouldn't work. And in some cases, we expect that perhaps our cement won't adhere properly and we're going to be left with gray sludge instead of concrete. That's relatively easy to see. But in 36 years, we'd never experienced this problem with an alkaline reaction. Any number of odd reactions might happen with cement. I suppose we might get radioactive cement. That's a possibility, but it's not one that we expect nor one that we have plans to deal with. This is a very abnormal situation and one that is not within the realms of ordinarily just cement failing to perform. If I may resume then, I'd like to touch for a moment on Midway because the other side has indicated that they feel the Midway component rule bars us. I don't feel that it does for two reasons. First of all, the product in this case is cement. It doesn't have any components. We bought cement. The cement damaged the concrete. The concrete is not, we didn't purchase the concrete from them. It's not a component of cement. The whole idea with Midway is that you're anticipating that when you buy a product, it may damage itself. Fine. As far as I know, the cement has not damaged itself. It has damaged other property in a way that we don't expect. The other point about Midway is I note that this court has not applied it in at least one situation in which a public safety hazard was alleged, and that was Northridge. In that case, the asbestos and the fireproofing compound was alleged, they bought the building, and the asbestos and the fireproofing compound was essentially a component of the building. But this court chose not to apply the Midway component rule, although I'll be truthful, I couldn't tell if it was raised in the briefs to the court, but the court chose not to apply that. I think one of the reasons was the public safety hazard. The alternate reason why Wausau Tile should be allowed to pursue its claims, in the event that you do not accept our first argument, is that a safety hazard exception to the economic loss doctrine should be adopted. This is the question certified to the Court of Appeals, and by the Court of Appeals. Should any risk, or at least a certain degree of risk, of future personal injury to a third person allow the product's purchaser to sue in tort? Given that safety is the paramount consideration in permitting recovery in tort, as recognized by this court in Northridge, I think it is reasonable to permit a commercial purchaser of a product that's injured only itself to recover in tort if that product presents an unreasonable risk to health and safety. Now, in this case, this product presents an unreasonable risk. To be honest, I think it's much more likely that pedestrians will fall and severely injure themselves on warped and bowed pavers than that shoppers will contract asbestosis from asbestos fireproofing material. I think we deserve the opportunity to show this probability before a fact finder.
Counsel, if we agree with you, what is the sensible stopping point to the exception that you're asking us to carve out? Is this just a matter of clever pleading? When I think of the number of cases I've read on economic loss doctrine, I can hardly think of a case in which clever pleading couldn't have alleged potential personal injury.
I think the jurisdictions who have adopted this rule have found that they can apply it. And I think, as we suggest in our reply brief, that it's useful. Well, one, we take the primary test is the unreasonable risk to health and safety. That's a test courts are already applying in the product liability case. We suggested that the Salt River factors of the type of damage, the type of damage suffered by the property, the manner in which the damage occurs, and then the type of damage alleged in the pleading should be factors in looking at whether or not this is an unreasonable risk. I don't know if that answers your question, Justice, but I'd be happy to answer more. Mm-hmm.
One other quick question.
Sure.
On the fact. You stated at the beginning of your argument that you had paid out $2 million, apparently, for repairs. You haven't paid out anything for personal injury.
No, Your Honor. We have been presented with at least three formal claims of personal injury, and we're indirectly aware of about approximately 6 to 12 other claims of personal injury.
But those, as you said before, have a right to their own lawsuit if they desire.
At this point in time, yes, I would agree.
Well, let me just go back to Justice Steinmetz's question, too. What about the people who have had property damage? Do they have a right to a lawsuit against you? You said other property has been damaged by your supplying the product.
I would argue that they have nothing, they have no damages to plead, Your Honor, because we have
paid. Suppose you didn't pay. So on the one hand, you've got potential plaintiffs who have property damage. That is, other property other than the product, right? Is that right? And you've got plaintiffs who have personal injury as a result of a defective product, right?
Now, the
could you answer to, I'm not going to remember your answer.
Yeah, I'm sorry. You responded. Okay. Now, it's my understanding that the economic harm doctrine, which prohibits recovery of damages, does not apply to personal injury, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And does not apply where other property is damaged, property other than the product in question, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay. So you've got two kinds of lawsuit potential against you, right? Personal injury and other property. And my understanding is the personal injury, you've got lawsuits or claims, but you haven't paid. The other property, you've paid off, right?
Correct.
Okay. And what you're saying is you now want to recover for what you have paid and potentially what others might charge against you, right?
Yes, well, there's one other thing I should add, Your Honor. We also want to recover for the cost of what we view as remedying the public safety hazard.
Okay. So if the other people could sue you for personal injury and recover, then you could have forced these people on property damage to sue you and recover, right?
We could, Your Honor, but if we did that, to be honest, in some of those cases, I think we'd still have the other property damage would pose a safety hazard as well.
Okay. But why can't, your position, as I understand, is you can short-circuit having other people sue you by you're just claiming the damages and ultimately paying them.
Well, Your Honor, we'd have to prove any damages at trial. And if we haven't sustained anything by that time, obviously we wouldn't have any damages to pursue. I think the whole point, though, I don't know that I would impose that at the pleading stage because I think you want to encourage people to promptly remedy public safety hazards. And if I promptly remedy it, ideally, I won't get a personal injury suit and I won't get a suit for other property damage because I've already fixed that.
So your position is it's the same as if they had sued you and you paid off and therefore it's not economic harm?
At least at the pleading stage, yes, I agree that we should be permitted to pursue it and to prove those damages at trial. As Your Honors have observed, if we don't pay anything and we force those people to sue us and we win, there's no damages to pursue at trial. Let me talk a little bit about the three policies enunciated in Dannon and Jansen and why I think they support the adoption of this rule. The first is maintaining the distinction between tort law and contract law. Tort is concerned with protecting society's interest in human health, human life, health, and safety. Now, it's concern for life, health, and safety that's given rise to the exception for personal injury in the economic loss rule. And it's that same concern which would give rise to an exception for an unreasonable risk of personal injury. This allows us to still maintain a distinction between tort and contract law, but gives the court the flexibility to encourage manufacturers to promptly remedy situations which have not yet caused personal injury, but pose an unreasonable risk of causing personal injury. Now, it's true that a substantial number of jurisdictions, as appellees have pointed out in their brief, have chosen to reject this approach in favor of a so-called bright line approach, where only an actual personal injury will permit an exception, rather than the risk. But you have to ask yourself, at what cost is that bright line purchased? Is Wisconsin willing to require that its residents must be injured or killed by dangerous products before it will require remediation and impose liability on manufacturers? We see that as too expensive a cost for Wisconsin, and for that reason, we ask that the court adopt an intermediate approach. With regard to the second policy, protection of commercial freedom to contract, commercial freedom to contract is limited, certainly, where a defective product that is unreasonably dangerous causes bodily injury. As this court said as the Court of Appeals, I believe, said in Spicciola Farms, a manufacturer may not use warranties to disclaim liability in the case of bodily injury. If our goal is to protect human life, health, and safety, it is illogical to allow a manufacturer whose defective product has posed an unreasonable risk to transfer the entire cost of that remediation, of that public safety hazard, to the unwary and unlucky company who purchased that product. Well, it's true.
I don't know enough about cement business, but when you purchase loads of cement for your project, do they give you a warranty of any kind?
Yes, Your Honor, they do.
And you're within the contract bargaining as to what that warranty is going to do, or you buy from another dealer.
Well, as Your Honor is aware, generally these are merely exchanges of forms. But yes, we do have warranties, and we use those warranties for the risks that we expect. But where you have something abnormal, something you don't expect, as we say, where you have the high alkaline cement that essentially causes that introduces a foreign substance in the cement and causes it to distort and deform, that's not the kind of risk we normally expect, and it's not the kind of risk that we negotiate for in warranty. Obviously, once you've heard of it, I mean, once you know that your Ford Bronco will catch fire, once you know that a high alkaline cement can cause this, after that, you can negotiate for that. And people do, and we do now.
Ms. Erlandson, when you're talking about risk, isn't that very speculative? How do you pin that down? How do you prove what risk you're talking about?
Well, you do it just the way you do in product liability actions. You show that it's not just a sharp edge. I mean, it's not just a sharp edge on a desk. It's a jagged edge, and one in this place that's unexpected where someone can't observe it. It is a degree, it is a judgment call, but it's one that courts already make, I think.
Well, you're talking about remedying, right? You're talking about remedying the problem. My understanding is your product was used over a period of, was it 6 years? How in heaven's name do you go back and redo everything that was done during a six-year period?
Well, we went and redid approximately, as I understand it. Well, I'm not sure I understand your question. You're asking how...
Well, it sounds to me like when you're talking about risk,
right,
you're talking about a very speculative situation. Now you're telling us that you want remediation costs. And my problem is, how do you even estimate those remediation costs? You go back and redo everything that's been done during that six-year period? Is that what you're asking?
In our case, we're asking for actual remediation costs, and we'd be prepared to show that everything that we remedied was the removal of distorted and deformed papers.
So you're not asking for risks for the future. You're just asking for what you actually paid out.
Because of the timing of the suit, we've already replaced everything. I mean,
when you say replace everything, how many jobs did you have during that time? Do you know how many jobs you had during that time period that involved this product?
I cannot say with certainty, Your Honor. My understanding is that we replaced the papers on approximately 30 jobs.
Okay, and are those the only 30? That you had that used this product? I mean,
I can't say with certainty, Your Honor. I regret that I wasn't on this case at the lower levels.
Okay, so you can't estimate it's 90%, 70%, or 2%?
No.
Okay.
No, I can't.
But you're only asking for that which is paid out, not for anything in the future. Next year, somebody else may come up with a...
If we observe, you know, the wrong way asking for what we paid out, I mean, anything that created a risk, and we saw the deformed papers as creating the risk, we removed. Nothing happened. There's no risk. I mean, that we can see.
And then if someone, just to follow up on the chief's question, if someone in the tort area falls 2 years from now in an area that you thought was fine, then what? You haven't done anything about that. The safety hazard hasn't been taken care of, and the person has still a personal injury action against the people at the location, the owner of those papers at that time. Now, so it's really kind of a speculative thing we're getting into as far as extending the safety, the dangerous safety hazard that was pointed out in Northridge.
There is some speculation, but I think one could look to technology for assistance. One could say, for example, have you tested the other areas for the same problem? It's my understanding that as technology advances, we are now beginning to have tests to detect this reaction and given a thin slice of cement. So I suppose that the defendants could say, has everything been tested? I think at the time of suit, is it speculative? Yes, but if the point is to promptly remedy a public safety hazard when it occurs, then it's our obligation when we come in and ask you for those damages to say, this is the risk. The risk is what we've remedied, And we've examined the other things, and for whatever reason, we don't think that there's any other risk there.
What happened in the asbestos case? Had they all paid out all the damages?
I'm not sure what you're...
I'm talking about the case in which the public safety factor was set forth in our case.
That was the Northridge case.
The Northridge case. Wasn't that asbestos?
Yes, that was.
The case I'm referring to. Was it all in the future? Was it remediation that had already been done?
As I recall, no personal injuries had yet occurred in that case. And the only alleged other property damage was the contamination of the property with a substance that endangered public safety. So that was all future damages, so to speak. My understanding was that they came in prepared to show that there was a certain degree of risk and that would render the property unusable.
But there is just common sense-wise, there certainly seems to be a difference between asbestos, which is a product that I think is widely known to cause problems, and a cement paver, as I understand it, which is a block sitting on the ground or on some platform. That is what I am struggling with, is whether we want to extend that Northridge exception to this type of situation before us.
Well, as I said, I think asbestos, I mean, you look at asbestos, and asbestos, if prepared properly, if encapsulated properly, might be used. I mean, you wouldn't have the danger. If the fibers aren't going to float loose and be inhaled, there might not be a danger of carcinogen. So I don't know that asbestos, you could just look and say, well, this applies in any case with asbestos. I think you'd certainly look back at Northridge and say it was the manner in which the asbestos was used. And I think that you're not necessarily saying that all problems with concrete are going to be dangerous. You're saying that this is an unusual and abnormal problem, one that was not expected. And I will...
Well, you mean having concrete pavers buckle and crack and bend? I don't know.
No, we don't usually have...
Doesn't seem to be something unusual that might not happen.
No, Your Honor, may be thinking of porch sidewalks, which due to the freeze-thaw reaction will crack and buckle. But pavers are a unique, separate object, and those generally last for decades. We have any problem with deformation or cracking. That's not an expected problem in our experience.
That buckling or cracking is not an expected problem?
No.
What is a paver?
A paver, Your Honor, is, it's much like those tiles you see out on Monona, on the walkway to Monona Terrace. It's maybe 2 to 4 feet, say, wide. And in our particular case, what happened was someone would bowl. And when you step on one end of that paver, the other end goes up, causing a rather scary hazard for the pedestrian who previously was looking at level tiles.
So the paver, the word sounds like the person who's doing it, but that's not it.
No, it's not. I apologize for the confusion.
Well, you didn't invent the word.
Tile might be a better version. Our company is called Wausau Tile. I just wanted to quickly speak to encouraging the party with the best understanding of risks of economic loss to assume or allocate the risks. Manufacturers of products are already required to assess the possibility of foreseeable personal injury. To require them to additionally assess the possibility of an unreasonable risk of personal injury, I think will not impose an undue burden on them. It's something that they should already be considering in making the assessment of whether there's foreseeable personal injury. Furthermore, I think that most manufacturers, because of their ability to control and test large volumes of their products for dangerous defects or properties, are generally better situated to anticipate and test their products for these types of defects than purchasers who generally buy smaller quantities. And recognize that in some cases there may be individual circumstances that may affect the application of these policies. That's why we seek the opportunity to show at trial that Medusa, as a cement manufacturer, was in the best position to assess the risks of the High Oakland cement because of their knowledge of the cement's properties and because of their knowledge of specific details of our business. In conclusion, I guess I would just like to remind the court in reviewing the lower court's dismissal of our tort claims for failure to state a claim, this court must construe the facts set forth in the complaint and all reasonable inferences that may be drawn from those facts in favor of stating a claim. Based on the facts set forth in the complaint and all reasonable inferences that may be drawn from those facts, Wausau Tile has stated allegations of damage to other property. such as the damage to the structures adjoining the pavers and the pavers themselves. It's also alleged that personal injuries occurred. Alternatively, this court should draw all reasonable inferences in favor of finding that Wausau Tile has stated facts that merit the application of a safety hazard exception. We therefore respectfully ask that the court grant us relief.
Thank you, counsel. We next have Keith W. Kostecki. Is that how you pronounce your name?
Okay.
And you're dividing your time with Mr. Bird.
That's correct.
And you'll tell us how you want that issues divided, please. I know that Mr. Bird represents the insurance company.
Mr. Bird may address insurance coverage issues. He may also address some of the same issues I'm going to be talking about. Thank you. My name again is Keith Kostecki, and I represent the supplier of cement, in this case, Medusa. I think there are a number of points I want to first mention about what this case really is about. In some ways, it's characterized as though Wausau Tile would be left without a remedy here if the economic loss doctrine is applied. That is simply not the case. They have made claims for breach of contract. There are warranties involved between Medusa and Wausau Tile for the purchase of this cement. So it's not leaving them without a remedy to not allow them to pursue tort claims here. Furthermore,
I thought those claims were dropped.
The warranty claims?
Yeah. No?
No.
I misread it. Okay.
I think nothing that this court can do with respect to application of the economic loss doctrine in this case affects the rights of others, that is, purchasers of the tiles, or people who may trip and fall and be injured, to pursue claims against Wausau Tile, as well as Medusa or the supplier of the aggregate, County Concrete. Those individuals, somebody trips and falls and is injured, they can sue Wausau Tile, bring a negligence action. They could sue the component parts suppliers, if you want to call Medusa and County Concrete that. Those issues really aren't before the court, but those are and probably be subject to general rules of negligence, including the rules that apply to a bulk supplier of materials such as Medusa. But those individuals have claims, and to the extent that Wausau Tile is trying to implicate public safety here, I think that it's incorrect, because the individual, if we look at the tort system as inducing parties to take action or be held accountable with the ultimate goal of preventing losses, we look to typically the people who are injured to bring those actions. One other thing that I think we have to deal with at the outset, the contention is being made that somehow the problems with these tiles is in and of itself damage to other property, that somehow falls within the other property exception to the economic loss doctrine. I don't think that analysis can hold in light of the nature of this product. We're talking about a bulk commodity here, and you could talk about any number of bulk commodities, whether it be flour that's put into foodstuff or oil or anything you can think of that is sold in bulk and used to manufacture something else. It would be absurd to say that the end product is always another product or other property that gives rise to the exception. What the exception is meant to do is to talk about damage, collateral damage, if you will, to other property or personal injury. And when we focus on that and we focus on what the economic loss doctrine is intended to do, I think the prior decisions, most recently in Dainan and Jansen, support the application of the economic loss doctrine to prevent Wausau Tile from making these claims into tort claims. One of the threads that I see in Dainan and Jansen is that the court wants to encourage, and we as society want to encourage parties to allocate risk contractually. And in fact, that was done here, but that's something we want people to do. We don't want people to have to resort to the tort system to settle these types of disputes concerning the quality of a product, especially commercial entities. And to that end, that would be subverted here if we're going to allow Wausau Tile to say, well, we have a claim that somehow is contractual but yet unexpected. We have this, the argument's being made that Wausau-Tile didn't expect this outcome. Well, I don't think you can say that any breach of contract, any assertion by a buyer of a bulk commodity that the product was unfit for what they intended to use it for is somehow unexpected. We want to encourage people to bargain for that. And this, by making an end run in the tort system around that, I think defeats the whole concept of the Uniform Commercial Code and what we want commercial transactions to be about.
Well, let me ask you, based on these facts, is this truly the paver itself a unique product? This has never been tried before, that this gel, the silica gel, that this was apparently defective or did not meld into the concrete or the aggregate. Is this something that Medusa had no experience with? Is this something that was just bargained newly with Wausau-Tile?
Well, I guess in parts, it's not fully developed in the record, but this alkali silica gel reaction we're talking about is something that can happen when you have cement of a higher level of alkalinity, and it has to react with something else. In fact, the allegation here is it reacted with silica in the aggregate that was supplied by the other defendant, County Concrete, and that this happens. I can represent that this phenomenon is not unknown, and we would argue that it shouldn't have been unknown to Wausau-Tile either. Again, those are facts that really aren't a record, but I think it's unfair, and I think it would create a huge exception to commercial law to say, well, we didn't expect this particular outcome, so therefore we can step outside of our contract and our warranty and sue in tort, which is exactly what they're arguing here.
Is breach of contract separate from economic loss doctrine? You mentioned that they have two remedies. Well, a breach of contract.
They have alleged contractual claims here that the product that Medusa sold to them was did not meet the standards specified by the form contract. And specifically, there are industry standards that Medusa warranted that this cement would meet. Standards that are put out by industry organizations. So those claims are at issue here, but they're not tort claims.
I'm wondering if breach of contract is outside of the economic loss doctrine, or if it's noted that should be in there and treated the same way as other sales.
No, well, I mean, I think the economic loss doctrine only applies with respect to analyzing whether somebody claiming damages can encompass those in a negligence in a tort setting rather than in a contractual setting. If we look at Danen and Jansen and the concept of enhancing parties to contract for potential problems with a product, that's also thwarted with respect to, if we want to look at these personal injury claims that are out there. Again, the injured parties can bring those claims. Wausau-Tile here is arguing, well, we're remediating these claims, therefore, and because that's is something that may enhance public safety, we should be able to collect from you, Medusa, for doing that. There's a lot of interesting issues wrapped up in that, though, because...
Mr. Kosticki, why shouldn't they be able to do that, looking at the Northridge decision that came from this court?
Well, that's just what I was going to give an example of. Number one, if we look at a tort claim, if we look at a theoretical plaintiff who, let's say, trips and falls on one of these pavers, they could sue everybody in the chain if they want, and there probably would be a comparison against the property owner, Wausau-Tile, and let's say Medusa, the aggregate supplier, and of course the plaintiff itself. Now, if at trial a finder of fact, jury were to apportion negligence and say that the plaintiff in this overall scheme of things was more negligent, contributorily negligent than Wausau or than Medusa or County Concrete, Medusa and County Concrete wouldn't have liability for that claim, at least in Wisconsin. And when we, again, if we want to look at predictability and the goals of the Uniform Commercial Code, and that it is intended to be a national thing that governs commercial transactions, we don't have that with tort law, because different states can have different tort remedies and different ways that negligence is going to be allocated and allow recovery. So it's attempting to put all of that under Wisconsin tort theory when, in fact, perhaps anybody who was injured in different states would not be entitled to a tort remedy against Medusa.
What about the other property damage aspect of that?
Well, if we're talking about damage to the collateral property of these entities that buy the tiles, they would still have their claims against Wausau Tile, and I think they could assert a claim against Medusa or County Concrete. Now, under Danen and Jansen, whether they could recover against, say, Medusa because of a lack of privity, it might be the case in Wisconsin, but I don't know that it's the case in any other state.
What about the remediation that's already occurred in regard to other property damage?
Okay, well, and that brings up another interesting point. One of the allegations made in the complaint refers to a Texas case that where Wausau Tile was sued, and one of the allegations in that complaint, in fact, is that Wausau Tile was contractually obligated by warranties it issued on its products to go and replace these. And again, the thread here about talking about warranty remedies and stepping outside of that, I think becomes important, because if we want to encourage a manufacturer to warrant its product to a consumer, and then is bound to make good on that warranty, that would be a goal, I think, of the system. We want to make people bargain for that and not deal with that in tort. Yet if we're outside of a warranty and somebody like Wausau Tile is doing this because customer goodwill or other factors, but not obligated to do that by warranty, we're changing the rules and saying, well, they can come and sue in tort because they're doing it on that basis, and perhaps not because they're doing it because they're contractually obligated to do that. It's making the end user's remedy dictate what Wausau Tile's remedy is against its supplier. And again, I don't think that's what tort law is intended to do, at least in the confines of the commercial bulk transaction.
Is this one of the problems I see, and I know that opposing counsel got into this. The Chief Justice asked, well, how many projects are there? Are there 30, 90, or did you...
It's been represented...
Well, here's the question, I think, that concerns me about this. If Wausau Tile takes it upon themselves to go and fix, say, you know, we might have problems with these pavers, we're going to go out there and we're going to do all of them. And let's say it's, instead of doing three jobs, even though there have been no complaints, they don't want any, and they, in their business judgment, replace everything, and then want to bring that under, not warranty, but under some type of tort situation. From a business concern, I can see that then there's no way that anyone could figure out what the potential damages could be, because you have somebody, Wausau Tile, making that decision that they, because somebody in Washington, D.C. said these pavers curled, then we're going to fix everything that we did in Texas and Oregon or wherever. I'm just using it. That, to me, that is a problem of quote, expectation, and just what is expected to be covered under originally supplying the cement.
Exactly, and that's, I think, again, goes to the whole issue of why do we have commercial law? Why do we have the Uniform Commercial Code where we're looking at these kinds of parties dealing with risks, both known and unknown risks, allocating those risks, maybe insuring against those risks, at the outset of their dealings, rather than coming back and trying to engraft tort concepts that can vary from case to case.
You, counsel, you started to answer Justice Wilcox's question with the words, it has been represented that, in terms of how many jobs they had.
Again, all I have at this stage is what's, I think, been stated in the pleadings. There was a list appended to, I think, the second amended complaint that listed the various projects in which these tiles were placed and where they were taking them out.
What? Was that is that the total number of projects that involved these tiles, or was it?
At that time, we were told, and again, I don't know if it's a matter of record, we were told that there were more, but whether or not it's been necessary to remediate all of those projects, we don't know. And it's difficult, I mean, obviously we're not that far in discovery. Whether this reaction occurs even with the same cement depends also on the type of aggregate used. So you could have the cement used throughout, but depending on different kinds of aggregate, you may not have the reaction.
Can you explain, briefly, why the court made the exception in the Northridge case regarding asbestos to the economic loss doctrine.
Well, I think there the court looked at it and said, we've got a building, we've got a contention, and I think a well-accepted fact that asbestos can be a public health hazard. We're going to treat it because it implicates public health in this fashion as something which can be remedied in tort. I think I might point out that asbestos seems to be almost out there in a separate class of cases. It doesn't easily fit into the other concepts that have been employed in economic loss doctrine cases. I think it's interesting, though, when you look at the alignment of parties in that case, it isn't necessarily comparable to the alignment of parties in this case. There it was a building owner suing the end marketer, the manufacturer of asbestos, or manufacturers, the prime defendant, I think, was W.R. Grace. Really, what we have here would be, the analogy would be W.R. Grace, in turn, going and suing, let's say, its supplier of asbestos, saying, well, you know, you should be liable in tort, too. And that's not what Northridge, I don't think, went that far. Because again, I think you'd be drastically changing the law that's applicable to the suppliers of bulk commodities if you were going to go that far. So, in essence, I don't think that there's any violence done to, or any subversion of the goals of the tort system by limiting Wausau Tile to seek essentially contractual remedies here. The individuals and the parties that may have tort remedies against Wausau Tile and Medusa have those remedies intact. They can be pursued. To the extent that different jurisdictions' law may dictate the responsibility of all of those parties in that chain, I think that's as it should be. But that it would be, I think, making a huge end run around the commercial law concepts that manufacturers of this type of product and Wausau Tile expect to have the certainty in their dealings that their differences of opinion about the quality of the product are going to be dealt with in terms of their contract.
Could you clarify for me, if the trial court is completely upheld, what exactly is left of the plaintiff's complaints?
Well, at the very least, one of the causes of action is that the cement that Medusa supplied failed to conform to contract specifications. These shipments, I mean, these are bulk shipments that come over the lake or by rail car, are accompanied by bills of lading that contain, among other things, representations that it will meet certain quality standards. And Wausau Tile has alleged that Medusa has breached those standards, that the cement did not meet those standards, and has alleged a claim seeking contractual remedies because of that. And those are still vital. Those are still part of the underlying case that weren't even
breach of contract,
breach of warranty, breach of. I mean, I'm using the concept broadly, just to say though that it's a contractual, it's a warranty, it's a commercial law type of claim rather than a tort claim, and those are still valid. I mean, those claims are still there and to be litigated. The scope of the trial court's ruling was only to dismiss the claims that are grounded in tort.
What does the bottom line mean? What is the impact of having all of the claims and having only the claims that remain after the trial court's ruling?
Okay. Well, I think one of the impacts, and just parts of the fundamental distinctions between contract law and tort law, is that the tort law arguably has a broader set of damages that could be available if you prove your claim. An analogy here, that I think contract and commercial law is intended to get around, is just that. But, for instance, Wausau Tile is claiming that it's lost profits because of having to replace these tiles. I don't know that that's necessarily recoverable in a contract claim. It may be in some contract claims. That's subject to all sorts of rules about what was bargained for and what was in the contemplation of the parties. But in tort law, it's not so well defined, and arguably they can say, well, these are all of our consequential damages and we're entitled to recover them. But it raises a good point. I could analogize this case to, for instance, a case where an auto manufacturer buys 100,000 parts from a supplier for $1 a piece. If the parts fail and there's a safety recall and they all have, and the manufacturer has to recall them all at a cost of $10 million, in the context of a contract, we get into issues of, was that in the contemplation of the parties? Was that bargained for? Was that an issue there? Whereas in tort law, I guess conceivably they could say, well, we can collect unlimited damages even on a relatively small transaction, which again is, I think, thwarts the whole concept of why we have a uniform commercial code, why we encourage parties to allocate their risks contractually.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you. Mr. Byrd.
If the court please, my name is John Byrd. I represent Travelers Indemnity Company, whose interests are very much allied with Medusa's, because Travelers wrote an insurance policy for Medusa, and if Medusa has no liability in tort, there would be no coverage. To answer Justice Prosser's question, the insurance company would not insure Medusa for any breach of contract. I think it's important to...
And tort damages may be different than contract damages. That's the essence. Tort damages may be different than contract damages.
I think, Your Honor, the essence of the question is that the insurance policy indemnifies the insureds for occurrences, and a breach of contract is not, under law, an occurrence. And I don't think that's a matter of dispute in the action. The Court of Appeals has certified to this court the question of... how far Northridge is to be extended, if it's to be extended. And therefore, I think it's very important to look at Northridge. There was asbestos in a building which contaminated the air. The asbestos worked fine. In this case, the claim is that Medusa cement failed of its essential purpose and didn't make good tiles. So that's a very important distinction. And that intrinsically there is recognition that asbestos is a dangerous product. And along with other courts, this court carved out asbestos as a distinct, different matter. As the court said, it's the kind of situation where the court should impose tort liability because
asbestos is
different.
Where does it say that, counsel? I reread Northridge, and Northridge is not a personal injury case. It's a property injury case, isn't it?
That's correct.
And so where does it say it's only another property injury case because asbestos is different?
It does not say that, Your Honor, except the court did say that because you have to look at the kind of case it is. That in balancing the question of safety against contract, it was important to look at the kind of case it was.
Where does it say that? Court says the plaintiffs assert asbestos contaminated the building and they suffered damages by incurring expenses for inspection, testing, and removal, and by a diminished value of the property. The question we consider in this case is whether the plaintiff's complaint states a tort claim for relief in strict product liability or negligence. And then went on. We conclude that the complaint in this state can be interpreted as alleging that a defect in the property has caused physical harm to property other than the product itself. The alleged physical harm to other property consists of the contamination of the building with asbestos from the defendant's product, posing a health hazard. Accordingly, we conclude that the complaint states a tort claim for relief in strict products liability and negligence. And there was a contaminant, and we don't give anything for personal injury. All we're doing here is saying that that they can seek damages for remediation and the lessened value of the building.
Yes, Your Honor, that is correct. But the extension of that is the asbestos was removed because of the potential for personal injury. I don't believe the asbestos hurt the building. The asbestos had a potential of being in the air, which in turn could be breathed by people. And what I meant by kind of case, I think also in the case, there's a discussion of it is difficult to determine what kind of case it is, in the sense of whether it is a safety hazard case or not. And this court decided it's a safety hazard case, along with other courts, which carved out asbestos as a special rule. And our argument here is if cement, which comes in bags and is mixed with water and aggregate, may be deemed a potentially dangerous product, I would ask what isn't a potentially dangerous product? And that's the essence of the argument. I see my yellow light went on, so I'll quickly add just a few more points. I think Justice Babbage hit the point directly in where do you stop if you say that these parties could not contract as they have to disclaim consequential damages and limit liability to their contract remedies. Because if you extend the Northridge ruling to other products, you have successfully gutted the Uniform Commercial Code and gutted the right of the parties to contract. Injured plaintiffs still have remedies. The question here is whether an unhappy buyer of a product is going to be able to sue the seller because the product didn't perform as the buyer wished, and that's the heart and soul of the commercial loss doctrine. Thank you.
You still have some time, Mr. Byrd. Mr. Byrd, do you want to have more time? Okay, thank you.
Can I ask?
Justice Prosser has a question for you.
You don't want tort law involved. If you were representing Wausau Tile, what would you have done to protect Wausau Tile from what occurred?
I would have gone to Medusa and said, now we're interested in buying cement from you. We want you to warrant to us that not only the cement will fit specifications, but will be suitable for the manufacture of our tilers. We want to be, if you examine and warrant the suitability of this cement for our use in tilers. And Medusa may have said, fine, but that will cost X number of dollars. Because if we could do it or you could do it, the question of the component of the cement could either be determined by Medusa or by Wausau Tile. And that's true in every commercial transaction where a product is purchased. How much duty do you want to impose upon the seller, and how much duty do you want to impose upon the buyer? And that's going to be reflected in the purchase price.
And if Medusa would not give that warranty of suitability, you could seek out another cement supplier who would do it.
Exactly. If you don't like Ford's warranty, you can buy a Chevy.
But here also, that there still is, as your counsel said, there is the warranty action. The contract action is still alive and well and could proceed between these parties as far as whether there was a warranty, what damage, and what the costs are.
Yes, that's exactly right. That's still alive.
Your position then is that for Wausau Tile, what happened was completely foreseeable, and they could have taken action through contract law to cover themselves.
Your Honor, I don't want to represent whether this incident is foreseeable or not. I think that the question is, are you going to respect the contract between the two parties or not? If the contract if the contract obtains, then there's no tort concept here, and the inquiry will be, did Medusa breach its contract? And that is one problem with not recognizing economic loss rule, is the problem of foreseeability, because then you have virtually the argument that virtually anything is foreseeable. And sellers of cement or sellers of any component part, the myriad number of component parts that go into a machine, need and want the protection that they're not going to be exposed to almost unlimited liability that would arise from tort. As in this case, there's discussion of $1 million, and for a cement manufacturer who manufactures bags of cement, that is the difficulty. It gets too far extended. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Byrd. Ms. Erlinson, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Oh, I can tell you now. Justice Ann Walsh Bradley is not participating in this case. That will explain her absence.
All right. Let me address a number of things. The first thing is, both counsel touched on the availability of contract and warranty actions. As the justices noted, there's a substantial difference in the damages one can get in contract and tort. Most warranties, including, I know there's some dispute as to the language of this, in this case, disclaim consequential damages. We might be able to get the cost of the cement. It's not clear that we'd be able to recover the $1 million cost of removing and replacing the pavers in question. And it's not clear that we could recover the over $100,000 that we spent on fixing other people's property. Those typically are not damages recovered in contract. That's why parties seek tort damages. As far as foreseeability, the distinction between contract and tort is important. But as we said, you can only contract and allocate risks that you foresee and that you expect. In this particular case, this was not a foreseeable or expected event. This was not the type of thing that one could allocate in the warranty or in the contract. We deserve the chance, I think, to show that the facts in this case support our contention that these damages are not foreseeable. There was some discussion of Northridge. I'd just like to point out the numerous similarities between the two cases. In both cases, the product essentially worked. The fireproofing protected against fire. The cement created concrete pavers. In both cases, a property of the product, whether high alkalinity or the fibrous and carcinogenic properties of asbestos, caused contamination of the other property with a foreign element. In our case, silica gel, in their case, asbestos. That caused damage to the other property. It caused damage to the pavers, it caused damage to the mall, it caused damage to our customer's property. And both cases caused a risk of personal injury, and in our case, actual personal injuries. Both cases also involved a high-traffic public area. I think our cases are very similar, and for that reason, I think, on the first argument, relief. With regard to the safety hazard, I think that let me just look at his argument here. There's one point. He points out that this is a bulk commodity. He says it's like oil. I don't think it is like oil. I think cement only has one reasonably foreseeable use, and that is to be made into concrete. We know what happens with concrete. And I think that, in that sense, that we're not asking them to foresee that much. We're asking them to foresee this one chemical reaction. It's not as in the case of oil, where there might be multiple different uses. We also spoke to Justice Wilcox's concern that if one goes in and remedies everything quickly, one might be making it difficult to see whether there is an unreasonable risk. The burden of proof would remain upon us as plaintiffs to show that there is an unreasonable risk. If we are so foolish as to remedy without, along the way, documenting that risk and the extent of the risk posed, then we will have sabotaged our own case. I don't think that we will remedy anything without careful documentation. For that reason, we ask relief on both the grounds of other property damage and personal injury alleged, and that a safety hazard exception should be adopted, and that we have met the facts that would require, that we've met the standard that should be adopted for a safety hazard exception.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to all counsel. And we will be in recess until 1:45.